Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to CrimeWire. An elite team of veteran investigation experts, along with noted crime consultants and attorneys, often featured on the popular news program for families of violent crime to find answers and seek justice. The CrimeWire team, Vito Colucci Jr., private investigator and author, Denny Griffin, retired investigator and author, Susan Murphy Milano, violence expert and author, are there on top of the crime at the top of their game. CrimeWire is the place for information, news, safety, and most importantly, justice. Our interactive website is www.crimewiresite.com. You can call in any time during the show. The number is 1-646-478-0982. And remember, you can participate in tonight's show simply by going to the live interactive chat room here on Blog Talk Radio. If you are a friend or a family member and would like to send the CrimeWire team information on an unsolved or suspicious death case or want to be considered for a segment on a case for a future show, please email us at thecrimewire@gmail.com. I'm Donna Pendergast, filling in for Susan tonight. Before we go to our first segment, Vito, I think you want to give us an update on Susan and what Susan's doing in Oklahoma, so why don't you take it away?
Well, thank you, Donna, very much. Susan Murphy Milano, as everybody knows, one of our co-hosts, she called me a few hours ago from Oklahoma, and she asked me if I can kind of give an update to some of our listeners as to what is going on. And I know many people know, but there's also many people that do not know. Susan Murphy Milano, she was invited to Garvin County, Oklahoma, recently by three families seeking to reopen cold cases involving the possible murders of their loved ones. Known as the Garvin County Three, these families have been victims of the worst miscarriage of justice. The cases of Sheila Davini, Shonda Turner, and Tom Horton are being reviewed by Susan Murphy Milano and the people that she has with her. You know, in a situation like this, it's been a little bit hairy for her out there. The climate out there, there's threats that are going around to different citizens, businesses, and even churches who have hosted events with Susan Murphy Milano. Susan is there for just one reason, to ensure that the Garvin County Three, as those three families are called, and several other families have a shot at justice for their murdered loved ones. And she requests prayer for herself, for safety, for her and everybody else connected in this endeavor, and that justice would be served. So please keep her in mind. If anybody has the opportunity to make statements via the internet or maybe different ways through Delilah Jones, that we can voice our opinions to help Susan, because it's a difficult situation. Like I told Susan today, I've been out to Oklahoma. I was out there the end of April, early May, to visit my family out there, and it's a very interesting state, to say the least. So I just promised her I'd start off the show with that. So I guess from here, any questions, you could always check with any of us about what's going on. Check with Delilah Jones, who is taking care of the day-to-day affairs of Susan out there and everybody connected. So, Denny, I'm going to turn it over to you, okay?
Thank you, Vito. And before I get into tonight's first case profile, I just want to mention that the poll results from our poll about the Connecticut triple homicide case in which we wanted to know if the prosecutors did the right thing by not accepting a plea offer from the defense for life in prison, and they instead went to trial to seek the death penalty. By 87% to 13%, the voters felt that the prosecutors did the right thing by going to trial to seek the death penalty. And we have a new poll we posted this afternoon about the overcrowding, the prison overcrowding situation, and what can be done about it. And you can answer any of the pre-formatted answers, or you can also choose the other box and put in your own idea. You can go to the crimewiresite.com and take that poll. Now, on August 23rd of 1990, 22-year-old Cheryl Henry and her 21-year-old boyfriend, Andy Atkinson, were brutally murdered in an undeveloped wooded area of western Harris County in Houston, Texas. Both victims had been tied with a rope and their throats slashed. Cheryl had also been raped. 17 years later, DNA evidence from semen found in Cheryl Henry's body was matched to DNA collected in the unsolved 1990 rape of a 30-year-old woman, also in the Houston area. Investigators were then able to release a composite sketch of the suspect based on the rape victim's description. And joining us tonight to discuss this tragic case are Cheryl Henry's father, Bob Henry, her sister, Shane Blaine, and Andy Atkinson's father, Garland Atkinson. Welcome to all of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And before we get started on that, I just wanted to give out the website where people can get more information on this case and also see a composite photo, a composite drawing of the perpetrator. And somebody has to have seen this guy at some point. So please go to http://helpcherylandandy.com. That's help, HELP CHERYLANDANDY.com. You can browse the site and get more information. And also, you can take a look at that composite photo, and hopefully somebody somewhere will recognize this guy. And this case may be able to be resolved. Okay, let me start out with you, Bob Henry. Take us back, if you could. I know it's got to be difficult, but to that 20-some years ago, and what happened that night?
Shane can tell you in great detail. She was with her before. I'll tell you what I know. They had been to Bahama Mamas in Houston, and she and Andy and her left, I think, about 10 o'clock, and they drove by some gas station and gassed up. Then they went out to this cul-de-sac. Shane may remember the name of the street that it was on. And Andy, from what I understand, had got a golf club from his grandmother, and he wanted to test it out. It was at night. It was about 10 o'clock. It was dark, but it was a big area with a lot of grass and things. So he had hit five golf balls, and the police recovered all the golf balls, and I think they recovered the golf club. And my understanding is that there was a little knoll there where he was hitting the golf balls from. And Cheryl was either there or in the car, but she struggled in the car because the sun visor was broken, and there was blood on the left doorknob. Anyway, to this day, I don't know, it was one or four people, but we know this guy that raped the other girl was definitely one of them. And they found her. This was 10 o'clock that night. The next morning, she didn't show for work, is when people started wondering what's going on. And we finally got a call. I got a call about 5 or 6 in the evening. We all went over to this area where this guard had found the car abandoned. And the police were out with a dog looking for Cheryl and Andy. And finally, towards dark, they did come across her in a sort of grave with boards on it. And I was able to tell, they came to me and told me what was going on, and I was able to tell Shane what had happened, and Barbara, her mother, was able to be comforted by Dan, her husband, at that time. And then the next morning is when they found Andy. They didn't even find him that night. He was at a tree about 150 foot from where Cheryl was at a clump of trees.
Thank you, Bob. Shane, and do you recall the events yourself?
Well, that evening, our last evening together, Cheryl and I went to that place, the club, and met Andy up there after he got off of work. And I left them shortly after. It was about 10 o'clock, like my dad said. I left them and went home. And the next morning, I went to go pick Cheryl up for work, and she wasn't there. And I really didn't think anything about it until that morning. The next morning, about 10, is when her work called me, and a friend of hers said that she never called in or showed up. And that was just very much unlike Cheryl. She was about to become permanent at her job, and she loved it, and wouldn't have done that. That just wasn't Cheryl. I spent the rest of the day getting her friends together, and when we got off of work is when we started driving around Houston looking for every place that we could think of that they would have gone, since they weren't at any of our friends' houses. And then I ended up, when I got home from work, I called in missing persons report, and it went to Houston Police Department, even though we were in a different county. And they soon met all of us that night. We got the call from the security guard. He found Cheryl's ID in the purse, and the purse was still in the car, where it was Andy's car that was on the cul-de-sac. And we all met out there, and we called the police a couple times, and when they showed up, I mean, just next thing I know, there's dogs and helicopters and police everywhere, and there was, I would say, about 50 to 75 of us out there. I'm still to this day don't know how the family all showed up, but and friends and church friends and just everybody combing, looking for her. And when the police arrived, they stopped us from looking, and then they found her at about 11 o'clock that next night. And then they stopped the search so they could focus on her. And then the next morning, like my dad said, is when they found Andy. The crack of dawn is when they found him.
Shane, if I may, this is Donna. Just so our listeners understand the sequence of events, you and Cheryl were actually at a club the night before. Is that correct?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, and that was Bayou Mamas?
Yes, Bayou Mamas. It was also,
okay.
Well, I'm not sure, location, but it's centrally located in Houston, close to where we lived.
So can you tell our listeners, who was at Bayou Mama's besides you and your sister Cheryl?
Well, it was just Cheryl and I. We didn't know really anybody there. None of our friends were there. It was a Wednesday night. It was, you know, I think clubs are, you know, popular on the weekends and Wednesdays or Thursdays. And then Andy met us there after he got off work at the Gold's Gym.
And Andy had been dating Cheryl for how long?
They've been dating exactly 2 weeks that day. Not very long. He had just moved here from North Carolina, I believe, right, Garland?
Right. Mm-hmm.
Okay. He had just moved here and was living with his grandmother. So he was new to town. I think he'd been here a couple months.
And did they tell you that night when you were all at the club what their plans were for the rest of the evening? Did you have any idea?
No, I assumed, this is me assuming, she wanted me to take her purse with me because it was a big, huge Louis Vuitton that, you know, you don't want to carry it around like a suitcase. She asked me to take it home with me, and I told her no, which I'm so thankful for being selfish at that moment because that's how they found her. I don't think they stayed too much longer, and I still don't understand why they drove out to this cul-de-sac. It was known as the Lover's Lane, it turned into. I remember going there in high school. We would all go there to hang out with our friends. But I still don't know why they did it. When they had friends' apartments in my apartment, they could go to. But that's what they chose. They chose to go out there, and I believe because they had started playing golf with my stepdad and my mom, that maybe they went out there to shoot some golf balls is all I could think. But I don't think they were followed. I don't feel that someone forced them to go out there because of the way the car was and the way they played, you know, they hit some golf balls for, it seemed, you know, for at least a half hour, an hour. And the way the car was, you know, it looks like they were approached by someone because there was blood all over Andy's side of the car and the windows were down. And on Cheryl, I believe they were in the car when this happened, obviously, because the visor was torn off on the passenger side. Like Cheryl was trying to grab something to not get taken out of the car. So I believe whoever it was showed up when they were already there.
Garland, I want to bring you into this in just a second, but there's a couple of questions from the chat room I'll throw out. One of the questions is, was there, I guess this would be for Shane, problems with anybody in the club that night? Was there any reason to, you know, any arguments or anything, or was everything peaceful?
No, it was very peaceful. I was there for about 45 minutes before Andy showed up, and I stayed for like 10 minutes while Andy was there. But there was nobody we knew there, and it wasn't that crowded, so it was maybe a third full, because it was still early in the night considering to go clubbing. So it really was nobody there we knew or any kind of arguments or any kind of fighting or anything like that going on at the time.
And thank you. And the second question is when the police questioned or talked with the other rape victim. Do any of you know if there was any connection between the other rape victim in that same club? Was that connected to her rape also? Had she been at that club that night possibly?
I don't believe so, because I believe the rape of the other victim happened, I believe it was 2 months or 2 weeks before Cheryl passed and Andy passed.
It was 2 months, I think. It was in June.
Yeah,
it was in June of 1990.
Okay. Garland, do you have anything to add or... regarding what happened that night, you know, from your perspective?
Well, no, you know, I really don't. Andy had came by my apartment that afternoon before he had went on the date that night, and I just got a new Camaro, and the computer chip kept screwing up, and the car would just go dead, and he wanted to borrow my car for the date. And I told him, I said, you know, I'm going to take it and get it fixed. You can use it the weekend, and that was the last time I saw him. And my mother called me the next afternoon and told me, you know, Garland, Andy didn't come home last night. And, you know, he was 21, Cheryl was 22. And, you know, this is something you never consider happening to you or any of your loved ones. You just don't think like that. And I told my mother, you know, don't worry about it. You know, maybe they went to Galveston. It'll be okay. And about 9:30 that night, she called me back and told me that they had found Andy's car. And it was like, you know, horse kicks you. You know, they found Andy's car. And I asked her where. And I went out there, and Shane, who I didn't know the family, I had never met Cheryl. They were there, and I have a pair of shorts on, a short-sleeve shirt, and the mosquitoes were so bad. I mean, you would walk out in that field, and your legs and your arms would just go black with mosquitoes. And I was... at the edge of the field when I saw the two officers stop and shine their flashlight down, and I started going that way, and they stopped me and said, no, the little copse of trees where my son was tied, I must have walked through that area two or three times. I never seen anything. Maybe it was, maybe I wasn't supposed to see my own child like that. And that was the very area where they had found him at daybreak the next morning. But I guess maybe the most difficult thing for me to accept was the homicide detectives had talked to me, and they said that they surmised that there was no scuffle marks around the tree where they had tied Andy, and I'll always believe it was more than one person. And they said that it was as if maybe Andy let them tie him to the tree, hoping maybe they wouldn't harm him, and that he was killed last, which meant, you know, as close as he was to where they were brutalizing Cheryl, he had to listen to that, knowing, you know, he'd probably be next.
Yeah, I just can't, you know, I can't imagine. I mean, it's tough to even contemplate what that had to be like. It's just,
Hey, Denny?
Yes.
Denny?
This is Bob.
Yes.
Let me add one thing. Both Cheryl and Andy were very strong. And
true.
Once they knew that something was going on really, really bad, they would have fought. They would have done something. So I don't know if they had something besides a knife on them or whatever, but we've always wondered about that.
No.
Hey, Denny. Go on.
Yeah. No, I was just going to say, I know Vito wanted to get in too, so whoever, Vito or Donna.
Yeah, Denny, let me say this. I mean, obviously, the biggest thing that has happened on this case is the DNA match. Okay, the crime was committed 20 years ago. Our listeners need to understand that. But then 17 years after that crime, which is 2007, if I'm correct here, the DNA evidence from the semen found in Cheryl's body was matched to DNA collected in another unsolved 1990 rape of a 30-year-old woman, also in Houston. And because of that other rape, where the woman was able to give a composite sketch, at least, of the suspect. I know that's 3 years ago, but it is a progress report. And I want to ask the guests on our show, the members of the families there or whatever, how did they feel when that information came to them in 2007 about the composite picture and the DNA match?
You want me to take that, Garland?
Yeah, go ahead, Bob.
What was described to me by the police was it was a town just southwest of Houston where this girl was raped, and the sheriff there had not put the DNA in CODIS. Everybody knows what CODIS is. It's CODIS. It's a matching system for any sexual perpetrators in America. And as soon as he put the DNA in, which he hadn't done in all those years, it hit right away. It hit a positive.
Well, wait, let me ask you, sir, I'll stop you on that point there, because that's amazing to me. You mean from 1990, they did not put that DNA through the system?
Because it was
at the
sheriff's department.
Let me answer that. It was actually the morgue. The morgue, not the sheriff's department. It was actually the morgue that sat on it for 17 years and didn't put it into CODIS.
Okay, I was told it was the sheriff's department. Okay.
Yeah, no, it was the Houston City Morgue. And there are many other cases out here that have not been put into CODIS that is a backlog in the morgue in Houston.
Well, yeah, a backlog, but, you know, 17 years is not put into the system. I don't, as an ex-cop, I don't understand that. That's not making any sense to me, What did they tell you?
Well, I think at this point what they were doing at the time that Cheryl and Andy were murdered is they were looking at similar cases. This man went from raping a woman 2 months prior to murdering and raping two people. I mean, not raping Andy, but raping Cheryl. So the crime did not fit. So I don't think they looked at that to run that DNA at the time, because it was not a similar case. Because as police officers, y'all look for similarities, and there was nothing similar except the rape part.
Well, you know, let me break in here, because clearly, you know, we have a serial rapist here, but if I might, Vito and Denny, just for a second here, just so our listeners understand the details of the other rape, 2 months before Cheryl and Andy were murdered, the other victim was accosted also in Houston. She was working at a topless club, got off work about 2 a.m., I think it was June 30th, if I remember correctly, and she returned home to her boyfriend's house. Her boyfriend was a commercial pilot who was off traveling, and she got in and, you know, had some fast food. And as she was walking upstairs, a man popped out of her bedroom with a fishnet stocking over his face, black gloves and a dark shirt and pants on. He asked specifically, "Where's Randy?" And Randy was her boyfriend's name, of course. He then put a gun to her head once again. Duct taped her hands behind her back, which is the same, you know, the same factor we have at this crime scene. And she obviously was a little bit luckier than Cheryl and Andy were, but he put a pillowcase over her head and brutally raped her. But he had some inside information about her. I mean, clearly he knew her boyfriend's name. He was in the house when she got home. You know, he had a plan.
Well, excuse me, I didn't know all that was known.
Oh, yeah. So, mm-hmm. You know, you have a serial rapist here, so how he came upon Cheryl and Andy, had he been following them, you know, this is an organized predator. I mean, you know, the first incident, the first scene, he knew where he was going. Now, you know, a person like that, as you indicated earlier, escalates. Did he come across Cheryl and Andy inadvertently, or had he been following them? Who knows? But, you know, it's interesting. He did rob the first victim. He took money out of her purse. I know Garland, in this case, that Andy's watch and his money were still at the scene. Is that correct?
Yes,
yes,
and so was
yes
Cheryl.
There was. A, yes.
Donna?
Hey.
Donna?
Yeah.
This is Mr. Henry. Mr. Henry. This airline pilot that was this girl's boyfriend, do you know what airline he worked for?
I do not know that. I just know he was off traveling for work-related purposes.
I think he may have been a private pilot. He worked for a private company. I'm not sure that he was a commercial pilot, as you were.
Okay, I'm just wondering, because I'm a pilot, and I just wonder if there's some tie in there, that's all.
Hey, Donna?
Right.
Donna?
Yeah.
Do we know of any, since this is two incidents, do we know of any other incidents that happened? I mean, usually an individual like this, you know, will not stop at that. Do we know of any in 91, 92, 93, anything following at all that's kind of like this, or no?
You know,
or maybe our guests know if there was any other ones that they heard of?
No.
We pleaded to women if they'd been raped at this time and had not come forward, to come forward, or to, if they knew this person, cause, and they also did an age enhancement to what he might look like today, but nobody did come forward. So and I don't know if the morgue has been looked at rape cases, if the police, I'm sure Officer Miller has gone back and looked at cases of rape victims at that time, but nothing has come up. As a matter of fact, I think I know he did. And he thought he had some really good leads, but nothing's panned out.
And, you know,
Detective Miller, they got 115 people called in from this thing being in the Chronicle and on TV when she came forward. And he's gone over all those cases, and they still haven't solved it.
Well, you know
let me add something about the DNA. The Houston Crime Lab was in a shambles a few years after this had happened, and the DNA was in the custody of our DPS, the Department of Public Safety, which is like the Highway Patrol. And they could not get the DNA tested at their labs, and they were farming it out to a company in Dallas, I think, called Orchid. And I had some emails at times with names and you know, when it gets frustrating, because you say, well, you know, just check the DNA, and it's a no or a yes. And it was, we always seem to run into a roadblock of, we can't afford it. We can't take DNA from every name, which I understand that, unless maybe it's viable. And if I've got a feeling about it, I mean, I even offered to pay for the DNA on one particular guy about a year and a half ago, because they said they didn't have the resources to do it. Their funding had been cut off. And I was told, well, we can't accept that. We can't go outside of the department. They wouldn't even let me and my family pay for DNA that we wanted to get tested from a name that I may have came up with. And that was really, really frustrating.
Well, you know, unfortunately, it's not an unusual circumstance. Houston's lab had the same problem that we've had here in Detroit, and that is the lab basically was in shambles and got taken over. One fortunate aspect of this case is that the testing done through ORCID was actually affiliated with Baylor University, so at
right.
least you got good DNA.
Right.
You know, it's not like somebody can question the DNA that ties the two cases together, but, you know, in terms of getting, you know, multiple suspects tested, that's always a problem, yeah.
True.
Donna, Bob here. On this DNA, they have checked 36 people in the Houston Police Department. And back when they had problems with their DNA lab, they had a guy in there that was supposed to be doing DNA, and he didn't know what he was doing, and they've had to redo 400-some cases in Houston because of it. But I called Chief Hurt. He was the chief at the time, and he set up a meeting where I come in, and we all met, the DNA people, his lieutenants and everybody, and I just wanted DNA checked on, like, four guys that we were thinking did it. And they went ahead and rechecked the DNA to make sure it was right for all 36. So the Houston Police Department has gone out of their way to try and resolve this crime. They've done very good.
Folks, I hate to do this. I don't know where this half hour is gone, but
I know I was just going to say it flew. You know.
I do want to close with this. Now, this case is going to be on America's Most Wanted, and I believe they're shooting for January. Am I correct?
December or early January.
Okay, I would appreciate it if you or Citizens Against Homicide would get back to us and let us know when you get an air date for that.
Certainly.
And what we'd like to do is do an update maybe the week before the America's Most Wanted broadcast, and we can get an update from you. We still got a lot of unanswered questions we didn't get to tonight because we've run out of time. And we can also let our listeners know, you know, when the episode is going to be on so they can watch it. Would you be willing to come back on?
Sure.
Oh, yeah. Yes.
Okay, well,
Go on, Edito. I just want to thank everybody that was on tonight, Bob Temnery, Shane Blaine, and Andy Atkinson's father, Garland Atkinson. Thank you, all of you, for joining us tonight in... We look forward to an update in an upcoming show. Thank you very much.
We thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, everybody.
Okay, before I introduce Monica Kaysen of Q to discuss the case of Troy Jacobs, let me give our listeners across the country a little background on this case. Troy Lee Jacobs has been missing since February 26, 1996, Troy was last seen at a convenience store in Red Springs, North Carolina. He was seen getting into a black vehicle with more than one person in the car. Troy had expressed to his father earlier that evening that he was concerned for his safety. Foul play is suspected, and Troy has not been seen since. All searches for him have been unsuccessful. His age at his disappearance was 21 years old, 5'6", 130 pounds, and his race was American Indian. Okay, and we'd like to introduce from Q, Monica Kaysen. Are you there, Monica? Is she on tonight?
Hello.
Are we just?
Yes.
Monica, is that you?
I am. I'm here.
Hi, Monica.
Hi, Monica.
Beto Colucci here. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thank you.
Did you hear my introduction? What did I leave out, or what can you add to it at all about this this missing person?
Well, basically, you know, Troy was the youngest of three children, and his mother actually died right after she had him. So the father, James, had raised these three children by himself, and they're a very close-knit family, and He definitely expressed some concern for himself that night that he became missing, and his father had begged him not to go, but he went anyway. And, you know, he's been missing a long time, and there's just literally been no kind of clues. I mean, we've done everything in his case, and we continue to search for him, and we just cannot seem to locate any kind of clues about him.
Monica, let me ask you this. His father is now deceased, right?
Correct.
His father, James Jacobs. I guess the father said afterwards, after this occurred, that he assumed that it might have been because of some dealing of drugs or something to do of that nature that his son maybe was involved in, and he did not have the funds to repay this person or persons that he got into this car with. Is that the kind of information that you believe about this case at the time?
Well, what happened was he had expressed to his father that he owed some local boys some money. His father, he never told his father, but his father always assumed it probably had something to do with, you know, drugs or something like that, because he knew Troy was not hanging around some of the best people recently prior to his disappearance. And he also had expressed to myself, as well as law enforcement, that he felt like the girlfriend played a part in his disappearance. He didn't like the girlfriend, and she had called him over there to the house. And Troy, that's what Troy was expressing to his father, that he was kind of concerned about going over there. And his father said, why don't you just stay home and just, you know, sit tight. And I think he was going to try to help him figure it out. And then Troy's like, no, I'm gonna go over there anyway. And he did. So she was pretty much the last person to have seen him and has not always been truthful.
Really? Has she ever taken a – do you know if she's ever taken a polygraph, or is she still in the area there, or what's going on with her over these years?
I do not know. I would imagine she's still in the area because, you know, the Indian population, they don't go far. All of their roots are right there in that particular area. But no, to the best of my knowledge, she was never given a polygraph. I know she was, you know, talked to in depth and on more than one occasion. And when different sheriffs would come in and they'd reopen and reevaluate the case, I know she was talked to over and over again. But, you know, her story's always been that, you know, Troy left that night and with another guy and supposedly to go to the store. But that's pretty much it.
Well, I mean, that seems a little bit hard to believe on that part. I'm sure Donna and Denny would agree with me, because if you're into some people for money and this black car comes and you tell your dad, yeah, I'm going to go with them anyway, even though I fear for my life, there's something strange about it, whether it's through the girlfriend or just some pressure maybe by these people saying, okay, look, let's at least go talk about this money you owe us someplace or something of that nature. So, yeah.
I think Troy thought that he could definitely talk himself out of it, and he didn't leave his home in the car. He went to his girlfriend's house by foot.
Okay.
And then from there he was supposed to have left. Some guy came by and picked him up, was basically like, let's take a ride. And then that person is the one that said, you know, that, you know, he got in another car at the store, which really that car is the one that he got into from the girlfriend's house, if that makes any sense.
Is this still an open case for them?
It is. It is. And the sheriff was actually a patrol officer. The current sheriff now was a patrol officer when all this started, and he has always vowed to try to, you know, locate Troy and do whatever he can for the family, and he has kept and maintained communication and, you know, even above the detectives with the family, and he's done anything we've ever come up with, any kind of tip that's ever come up. You know, we've conducted searches, we've dug up backyards, you know, we've done a lot of things, but it's really, people in that community are so scared to talk. You know, there was a young man that came up in 1999 that had called me and wanted to meet me 100 miles away from the town. And I in fact, did go meet. And he wanted me to videotape his information in case anything had happened to him. And I didn't have a video camera with me, you know, kind of sprung it on me when I got there. So I took the information, and I was going to drive back up there in a couple days and videotape him and actually bring him in front of an FBI agent who he said he would speak to. And before that could happen, he was found hung in the woods.
Right. Wow. I know. I had read that, and that's the interesting part right here. You know, it's very strange. And in your notes here, it says that the people in the town, there should be answers in his hometown, but the people are too afraid to talk. Ring true?
Yeah.
Really?
I mean, they're terrified because they know. I mean, look what happened to the boy that stepped up, you know. And he had went through a local pastor to reach out to me, like he wanted to go through someone else. He wanted enough people that he could trust to know what he was doing and thought he was protected. And I thought that we would be able to protect him, too. It was only a matter of a couple days. And then, you know, that happened. And since then, nothing. Nobody talks. Nobody does anything. I've had notes flipped to me when I've walked out of the police department from meeting with them and tell and give me names of people. I turn around and go right back into law enforcement and give those names, but they won't talk. When you go back and say, it was that lady right there that, you know, slipped the note, she'll say, I didn't slip her note, you know, things like that. So there's been some really crazy things that's happened in that community.
Let me, maybe we'll get Donna and Denny to join in. Go ahead. Who's that, Denny?
Inspector Vito. Yeah, we've got a couple of callers on the line here, and I think one of them is Troy's uncle, Roman Jacobs. Are you with us, Mr. Jacobs?
This is Roman's daughter, Lou Evelyn.
Okay, can you hold on just a second? We've got a couple more calls. I'm not sure who they are, and let me just make sure whether they're involved with this segment or not. From caller from 910, first three digits, 471. Are you with us? Area code 910-471, are you there? Okay, well, let's go back then to Mr. Jacobs' daughter. Do you have anything you'd like to add to what Monica has already told us?
It's interesting that this talk show came about because it's been since 1996 that Troy's been gone. We lost his father in 2002. His mom had previously died before he went missing. His sister is terminally ill, and his brother is overwhelmed with problems in his own life. So it seems like the only connection to even remembering Troy is through Monica and the program that she has and just the family members that remember him. And we were talking earlier this week about trying to do something to remember him. And it's something that haunts you at night to know that somebody was born and actually walked this earth, had relationships with people, disappeared, and unable to locate him and have no answers to be able to put an ending to the story. And Monica and her team have been awesome with advocating for us here to try to help get some answers. But just like she said, it's just in the past week here in this county, we've had several people that have been found dead or missing, or it's just a challenge in a small rural area to get people to open up because they're afraid of letting you know any information. And I'm sure someone out there knows something. And we can only hope that eventually they'll get tired of keeping that information inside and decide to share it with somebody at some point in time so that we can bring some closure.
How big of a police department do you have there that was handling this case? How big of a jurisdiction are you talking about here?
At the time, it was a fairly small department. It has branched out in the last 3 years. They may have had three detectives at the time in that sheriff's department. And at that same time that Troy went missing, there was another case that occurred, and Monica can remember this. It was the case with Brittany, which was a young girl in Locklear. And they actually found her body. And it's almost like that case kind of overshadowed the missing issues with Troy for a long time.
Brittany was a 5-year-old child that had got abducted from a school bus stop and in front of people. I mean, by the time, like, the guy just stopped out of nowhere, grabbed her up right in front of parents and everything, and by the time people realized what was happening, it was too late. And the whole community went into a panic looking for this child. They found her book bag later on that day, and then her body, I think, was found late that night. And it was just a horrific couple days there, you know, with the searches and just, I mean, everybody. People were out there and barefoot, you name it. They were in a panic. And then that investigation just kind of overshadowed the next year, if you will, of that whole community because everybody wanted to solve the Brittany Locklear case. I mean, who could come in and take this precious 5-year-old child first day of school and murder her so violently? And so Troy did get lost in that. And there were searches that were conducted for him, and they were trying, but it seems, and it always seems, every sheriff has run on that platform about Brittany, and I know you'll agree with me on that, you know, that they vowed to solve the case, and that case still remains unsolved as well. So it's there's murder there all the time. Like, I mean, in most big cities, it outnumbers in that community, and a lot of the rural communities like that are that way. There's pretty much, you know, 1 to 5 murders a month, and so you have a very small department trying to, you know, with that challenge. So a missing person just keeps getting thrown to the back.
Hey, Donna and Denny.
Yeah.
What do you think about this? I'm still going back to the fellow that was hung in the woods. Obviously,
yeah, that's where I am, too.
Something got around this small town about this guy. So maybe he trusted a pastor, maybe he trusted Q. And I'm not saying anything against either one of those two. I feel comfortable with them. But there must have been other people, too, that maybe he confided in about his situation, and that person innocently enough told a loved one, and before you know it, it got around to the bad guys. What do you and Donna think about that? Because that's an interesting point of this case here.
I tend to agree with you, Vito. I don't believe in that kind of coincidence. I think there was a connection between his death and Troy's disappearance and the information he was providing. And on that note, I just wanted to ask Monica, apparently there are some real bad players involved in this thing. Did you feel that, you know, I mean, going 100 miles or so away to interview the source, did you feel that you might be in any danger? I mean, would these people, if they thought you were asking too many questions, where they might want to get you out of the picture?
Well, sure. I mean, I've never stayed the night there. When we'd go in and do searches, I always left, and that was one reason why. You know, a lot of times when we go in and do weekend searches or whatever, we bring in the searchers, we stay the night, what have you. Everybody drove in and drove back out, you know, which was a safety concern. I mean, I'm pretty well known in that area, and people know that anytime they see me, I'm down there looking for a missing person. But, you know, that community, as well as several others that I've worked in missing persons in, you know, that's always in the forefront of your mind, but you have to believe that you're somewhat protected or what have you. I've always been surrounded by law enforcement pretty much when I've been down there, so, and then when I've left, you know, I've always had my canine with me and that type of thing. So, you know, I mean, you work with safety, but you know, it's really the people in the community that have to live there. You know, their, you know, house catches on fire in the middle of the night, or, you know, their trash cans are lit up on fire, or someone throws one of those little stink bombs out, or someone, you know, drive-by shootings or whatever. And, you know, they're so intimidated, they don't, you know, they just kind of, it's not that they don't want to help, it's just they don't feel protected. And law enforcement has such a great challenge in front of them, and, back in the day when Troy got missing, I can tell you that the law enforcement that was in place then, nobody should have felt protected, you know, because it was a bad situation. Law enforcement they have now, awesome, you know, compared to what they had. And that was a lot of the problem, too. You know, they were not. I think if people went to law enforcement, they were thrown under the bus.
How about having a new set of eyes and ears coming in on the case, a new detective or something like that? Have they done that, somebody to come in and reopen the file?
They have not done that in the last few years, but when Sheriff Peterkin, one sheriff, you know, he put a new team on it, we did, you know, conduct a couple searches. And there is a couple pieces of information that, you know, we are aware of that still exist that has been information that's been talked about for years, but there's nothing to prove anything enough for them to get a search warrant. And that's been one of my biggest challenges is, like, we almost know who's kind of done this. We almost know where he may be at, but we can't get there. And so it's been a very frustrating case for me to know all the things that I know and and really not be able to rule the things out that have just lingered there and lingered for years. So that's one thing that, you know, I spoke to Rowan about. You know, we have to get answers. If we have to get an outside investigation to come in or something, but these things need to be put to rest because they've lingered around for quite a while.
Well, I know from, again, from a police point of view, you get this guy who's hung, that word gets all around town, and you're not going to get information from anybody after
yep.
something like that. In other words, they made a statement. Whoever was involved in that made a statement to the community that you could be next if you get involved.
And that boy really did. I mean, that boy was he was panicked. I mean, he was scared to death to talk to me, but he knew he could trust me because he trusted the person that brought him to me. And that person is a well-trusted figure in that community. And I think that it got out that he was seen with him, you know, that he was in probably, you know, not that anyone knew that he had told him anything, but just the fact that he was seen, maybe seen with him or seen speaking to him or something of that sort. And I think they just assumed he was talking and, you know, or what have you. But
Donna Pendergast, what do you think about what everybody's been talking about here?
Well, you know, the thing is, too, even at this point, if you had enough to get a search warrant, I mean, do you really think that, you know, 14 years later, there's anything you're going to find? No, probably not. Do we have somebody calling in?
No, I don't know what that's all about. It's on somebody else's phone, apparently.
I don't know where that's coming from either.
I don't know. Well, it stopped, it seemed like, so that's good.
Okay.
Hello? Hello?
Yes.
Hello?
Yeah? Do you have a question?
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah. Is this CrimeWire?
This is. Do you have a question for us or a comment to make about tonight's show?
I don't know how. My phone just rang and you called me back. I'm Andy Atkinson's mother. I was holding.
Oh.
And then the other story came on and... You know, so
all right,
know.
So we had a switchboard glitch of some sort.
Yeah, because I just
here.
Got off the phone with Garland, and I hung up, and my phone rang, and I picked it up, and y'all were talking like, what was that? And anyway,
okay,
it was
we were
me.
Trying to figure out where the ringing was coming from, so.
Yeah.
Well, if you
are we on the air now?
You're on the air. We signed off with that first segment at about 9:30, so I don't know what happened here with this high tech switchboard, but
maybe she could hook
how
up
phones
with.
Are. Okay, well, thank you all so much. I appreciate everything. I'm Andy's mother, and everybody. Thank you so much.
Thank
for
you,
all your
Andy.
Time and help.
Thank
okay,
you.
Bye bye.
I would like to say that the district attorney in Rayford. Has maintained a close relationship with our family as well. And she speaks to my father on a regular basis to let him know that this is a case that's not been forgotten. And
right.
like they were saying earlier, there are things, there are people that they have an idea that did this, and it's just a matter of whether or not you have the information you need to move forward with prosecuting anybody. I would like to see at least somebody go back and talk to the girlfriend, ex-girlfriend that he had. Maybe as the years go by and people get older, maybe they're not as fearful anymore, or those same people aren't around. You know, something just to get some answers for the family.
Let me ask
you a question. And I agree with that.
For you or Monica, there's a question in the chat room. One of the chatters wanted to know that Troy was hanging out with some bad people, and the question was, what types of bad people? Were they drug dealers or generally bad people? Do you know exactly what his friends or acquaintances were up to?
Go ahead.
I would say that Troy at the time was dating a girl. I think she may have even had a child. He was not a bad child by no means. He was a very easy, well-mannered person, but found other ways to get money at times. which is very prevalent in our neighborhood and in our community. And I think that he may have borrowed money from someone, and they were coming back to collect on that money. And he wasn't able to follow through with it.
A lot of the people in that community, some of the boys are, you know, they're rough boys. I mean, in general, you know, they're all, it's kind of like inner city, but a rural area, you know. Some of them, you know, are good kids, but they are brought up in the community around these bad kids, so they become friends with them and not necessarily hang out with them. But if people get in a bind or whatever, they might reach out to them. And, you know, so it's not like they hang around someone every day, but it's like, you know, like boys, certain boys, groups of boys have names for themselves, like, you know, stealing cars or getting in trouble or whatever. So their parents will be like, stay away from those boys. Like, and I'm just going to say, throw out a name, like the Wilson boys or the, you know, whatever. They'll say, stay away from those boys. But, you know, in general, if you go to school with them and things of that sort, you're gonna be somewhat friends or at least acquaintances with these kids. And, you know, sooner or later, they run into each other. And, you know, like I said, we really don't know what Troy was doing. We know all he expressed is that he owed some money and he didn't have it pay back. And that was, you know, he was worried about it. And, you know, if he would have, you know, I just wish he would have listened to his father that night, because his father was upset, you know, and begged him not to go or whatever, and he went anyway. And I think he thought, well, you know, I can talk my way out of it, or, you know, I'll just get a few more days or what have you. Or, and he was working, so it wasn't like he couldn't have found a way to maybe pay the boys back. So it just, it was a bad situation. And unfortunately, like I said, if you just look into the Hope County, Lumberton, Fayetteville area and Hope Mills area, which is highly Indian populated, there is a lot of crime, and the law enforcement, they don't have the support, you know, to fight that crime at the level that they have. And it's you know, it is definitely a funding issue. It's not a reflection of the law enforcement. They're struggling, you know. And I don't know, it's just, it's crazy. There's just a lot of crime, a lot of homicides, you know. It's not the average stealing cars and things, it's a lot of homicides.
Monica,
you know, that's not unique to that area. Unfortunately, law enforcement is struggling everywhere, and not enough resources and too many cases. I know everybody that's on tonight has heard the same story over and over again, but, you know, the bottom line is everybody is spread thin.
Yeah. Well, I mean, if you have a lot of homicide investigations, is what I'm saying is they don't have the staff, I mean, which nobody does, is, but, you know, if you're talking about taking, like, the size of the city of New York with their level of homicides, then, you know, look at the officers they have to work that. They have hundreds, 700, 800 per you know, sector. When you're talking a 26-year or 26-man, you know, law enforcement agency and only three or four of them are detectives, and you've got a homicide, you know, two or three a week. So that they're just buried in homicides is what it is.
Yeah. They're buried. We're buried up here. Denny,
oh, yeah,
you know, both seated. And everybody's buried. And, the unfortunate
Monica,
fact of life.
Monica, let me just I have another question from the chat room. If you know, just for clarification purposes, the source that you interviewed and then was found hanging in a tree, that case is still unsolved?
I believe so. Mm-hmm.
Okay, thank you.
I believe so.
Well, you know what? Unfortunately, once again, the half an hour has flown by and time has run out. So I think at this point, unfortunately, we're going to have to wind this up. I want to thank our guests tonight. I want to say thank you to Monica Kaysen of CUE. And once again, thank you to Troy Jacobson's daughter. And it is time. So thank you to the Crime Wire team, our director of research, Kim Colton, and Delilah Jones of our public relations team at ImaginePublicity.com. Our next show will be Tuesday, October 26, 2010. Tune in as we continue to analyze cases and crimes that interrupt and wreak havoc on families looking for answers, seeking justice.
And thank you for joining us tonight on Crime Wire. We always welcome your support and value you as our guests. If you would like your case to be featured on Crime Wire, email us at thecrimewire@gmail.com. And you can hear a rebroadcast of tonight's show at www.crimewire.blogspot.com. Turn on the volume at your computer and the show will automatically play. And please don't forget to go to our website and take our new poll survey about prison overcrowding.
Remember, we ensure that your voices will be heard. When there is nowhere else to turn, visit our website at www.crimewiresite.com. Good night and God bless from the Crime Wire team, Vito Colucci Jr., Denny Griffith, Susan Murphy Milano, and the very charming Donna Pendergast. Good night.
Good night, everybody.
Good night. Thank you. Bye-bye.